You know what? I feel like I need to correct something really quick, Amy. Hour two of the show. Good thing that you're all with us because we got a lot coming up for you.
Yeah.
I mentioned the lady who stole the jewelry and then posted herself.
Yeah.
With all the photos of it, and that's how they caught her. Daniela Draper is the name of the jewelry store. Lucy Roberts is the name of the perpetrator.
So that's like you just said some lady named Tiffany stole a bunch of crystal.
I've never heard of Daniela Draper, and clearly neither did you because you would have said something.
I've never heard of Daniela Draper.
Brian is watching us on YouTube and said, hey, you're stupid. That was fake news. So yes, correct. Lucy Roberts is the perpetrator. And a man who's never committed a crime once is Bernie Miklas.
Allegedly.
And he is allegedly, as far as we know. Cubs and Cardinals. Cubs are here visiting the Cardinals this afternoon at Busch Stadium. Finale of the series. Bernie, what's up?
Well, I misdeeds I'm guilty of, I'm a reformed man. I'm a changed man. So let's not live in the past here.
You're not here to talk about the past, Bernie.
That's right. That's right. I've been a good boy for the most part. Anyway, just waiting to see whether the Cardinals can win this one today because. Gosh, it would be great to take three out of four from the Cubs. The Cubs woke up last night. We saw that offense. I don't know about you guys. I said this before the series. I said, I would settle for a split, but the way the series plays out would change my view. And I even specifically said, look, for example, if you win the first two games of the series and then you have to settle for a split, it would be disappointing. Sometimes, say the Cardinals had lost the first two games of the series, and then they had battled back to get a split. Then you say, well, that's a really good job to get a split. So I would be a little disappointed if the Cubs left town with a 2-2 split.
That's It is exactly what happens every time a three-game series goes on. And, the Cardinals win the first two games of the series, but then they drop that third one. Somehow the series feels different than if they won the first, lost the second, and then won the third. It's always that last game that seems to matter.
And it's hard to win a four-game series. I don't have any numbers on that, but it really is difficult. And there's an X factor today because the Cubs are bringing back Shota Imanaga, who is a really good left-handed pitcher, and he had a hamstring injury. I think it was hamstring. And he's been out for quite a while, but he looked great in his minor league rehab assignment. So the Cardinals got completely shut down by Matthew Boyd, the Cubs lefty starter last night. And so I'll be curious to see how the fellas do against Imanaga, because again, he's a really good pitcher.
Yeah, and not having pitched in a while, you never really know how that's going to go down. So the Cardinals, they got blown out last night. That really. And we've talked about this on Gas House Gang, Bernie. That doesn't happen very often with this team. They may not be in first place in their division or in a wild card spot right now, though they're not too far out of either. But getting blown out of games or, just by the fifth inning or sixth inning, it's pretty much over. That has rarely happened to them this year.
No, you're right, Ron. I was thinking about that as you asked the question. And I can't remember the time, it might have been, there's always going to be a few times, but, remember Sonny Gray started that game in Milwaukee and that was really bad. And you had a feeling halfway through that was probably over. And then, the Toronto series, the Cardinals, they lost all three games, but they were competitive. And, if you go back through their schedule, which I'm not going to do, but yeah, I don't remember games where it was just kind of lights out by the third or fourth inning. It just doesn't happen. Or even in the fourth or fifth inning. It doesn't happen very often.
Bernie, last night during the game, Tony La Russa was on the FanDuel Sports Network broadcast during after the fourth or fifth inning. I can't remember which. And Alec Burleson made a play, and La Russa said something to the effect of, oh, hey, that looks like Larry Walker out there. Just making the comparison between the two. And I don't know that Burleson is Larry Walker, who was a really, really good ball player for a long time, but he has done so well with the Cardinals since he has been here.
His defense was pretty shaky in the outfield at first, but he's gotten better and better as time's gone on. And, I was looking at this the other day and was pleasantly surprised to see that, in terms of his performance in, right field, he's now at worst league average. And in fact, I wouldn't be surprised when they update it that he's slightly above average. And that's a big, big change from where he was, where you would almost wince when you saw him in the lineup in right field or even left field, because he wasn't very confident out there, but he's confident now. And he's making some great plays. And now when they hit a ball out there, I don't know about you guys, but I feel like, okay, he's got that, no problem.
Yeah.
You know, he's not the most graceful guy, but the bottom line is you either get to the balls that you should get to and make the play or not. And I admire how hard he's worked on his defense. And it helps Ollie Marmol out a lot too, because, you know, Burleson at this point is better in right field than Jordan Walker. And all the statistical metrics scream that, you know. So, no, Burley, I said, I don't know where I said it, but it's like the summer of Burley. To me, he's been the most fun player in the 2025 season for the Cardinals.
Hey, Bernie, yesterday was obviously something of a mess for the Cardinals. Not a great game, but as Derek Gould points out in his piece in the Post-Dispatch, there was a bright spot, and that was in the middle of the game with John King, a reliever who's usually out there for an inning, maybe a little bit longer than that, gutted it out for a few innings and really helped set the Cardinals up for and their bullpen for today. And that was the longest inning that our longest stint that John King has had since in a couple of years.
Yeah, and that's good because, you know, that's what he's there for. He's not a high leverage reliever, so it makes perfect sense for him. You try to squeeze as many innings out of him out of the bullpen in kind of a lost cause game, which last night definitely was. So that will give the Cardinals a better position in terms of bullpen use today or who's available. And if Andre Pallante can't give them five or six, if they have to go to the bullpen early, they'll have more people available. And, you know, that's kind of, it sounds crazy because nobody wants to get blown out.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a little value to be squeezed. If you're going to lose and get blown out, you can save your bullpen. You know, you can do things like have the position player pitch the ninth inning, Hampson, or squeeze more innings out of King. Because, you know, if game three of this series was lost and it was lost early, then everything should be directed to the final game of the series. And so Ollie Marmol did that, which he should have. It's obvious, but still, you see some managers who won't do that.
And then you have that outing from King, which was long, and then you have Garrett Hampson's outing. He pitches three pitches, three outs. You don't see that very often.
And I didn't even realize that. That's great info. I had kind of bailed out, to be honest with you, if I have to be like full disclosure. I had bailed out kind of early.
And that's okay that you've done that, because you need to for your mental health every now and then.
I wish I would have seen Hampson pitch. He's an interesting cat. He can do a lot of things. I think he's not a great, great player, but he's fast. He plays a lot of positions. Now we know that he can pitch. I guess he's like the right-handed hitting Michael Ciani, if you think about it.
Yeah.
The speed, the defense, right? You don't expect a ton of offense, but he can still help you. They needed somebody better than Jose Barrero to basically play center field against left-handed pitchers.
This Bernie Miklas report is brought to you by Saliga Heating and Cooling, saligaheatingandcooling.com. Bernie, this series again against the Cubs, they're going to finish up here, and then they will play the Cubs again in a week. Little over a week from now, they're going to play again. So I know that we have talked about on Gas House Gang just the fact that they had not even played this team until late June. But how important do you see these two series being for the Cardinals, knowing that the trade deadline is coming up in about a month?
Well, Chris, I know what you're saying. And obviously that return match up at Wrigley Field is going to be important. I mean, the Cardinals are going to have to, if not win the series, and I'm not saying they won't, but if they don't win the series, they can't get swept. They have to be respectable. But, you know, on top of that, I would also, you know, point out, and again, I'm not telling you or Amy anything you don't already know, I think all of these games before the All-Star break are very important.
Yeah.
Because let's just say you do well against the Cubs, like you win today, and then you win the series at Wrigley. That's really great. But what if you screw up and lose a series at Cleveland, or you lose a series to the Pirates, or you lose a series to the Washington Nationals, or Atlanta comes in here and wins two out of three? So even if you do a great job against the Cubs, you can still mess up by not doing a great job or even a good job against a lot of the teams that are on the schedule between now and the All-Star break.
No Gas House Gang today because it is an early ball game, 12:20 for the pregame show, and then a 1:15 first pitch from Busch Stadium. Cardinals Cubs wrap up the series. Bernie Miklas, we will do Gas House next week. We'll have Ollie Marmol on Tuesday, and we'll talk to you then.
Well, earlier this week, Governor Mike Kehoe revealed the St. Louis Police Board of Commissioners, the people that he has chosen to be on that board. I think the most prominent feature of that board is that it was a lot of business owners, which is, you know, good. It's great to have people who live, work, and run businesses in the cities. One of the people named to that board is the commissioner, Don Brown. And yes, that is the dealer operator of Don Brown Chevrolet. And the thing is, while we all know Don Brown Chevrolet, we know Don Brown is a longtime St. Louisan, a staple, yeah. Right? Knows the
commercials,
city.
Commercials. I know the commercials.
Commercials. Sure, he loves the city. As it turns out, the city spent $1.6 million at Don Brown Chevrolet in fiscal year 2025, with $1.3 million of that expensed by the St. Louis Police Department. In 2024, the city spent $1.6 million with $1.5 being expensed by the police department because they are buying those Tahoes that we've talked about so much in the news,
yeah.
The Tahoes from Don Brown. And it does feel like that the people are asking if there's a conflict of interest there, that you have someone on the board who's doing millions of dollars of business with the police department. Like I said, love St. Louis businessmen and businesswomen, and love Don Brown for what he's done for the city of St. Louis. I am not the sharpest tool in the shed when it comes to spotting conflict of interest. I feel like I'm naive in a lot of situations, but even I would see this and think, is that maybe kind of problematic?
Yeah, this probably isn't the best. And this was sort of, this wasn't the only concern I had with the governor getting a chance to, pushing for and then being able to then appoint all of these commissioners that sort of, you know, take some power away from the city and running its own police force, is I didn't know who he was going to appoint to do it. And Don Brown, I don't know him at all other than his car dealership, mm-hmm. and
boosted the St. Louis economy. We know that.
So, I mean, yeah, he's a car dealer. Fine. And you know, maybe he does really, truly have the best for the city in mind in taking this over. But it seems like one of those things that, look, even if he does have the best intentions of being on the on this commission, maybe this just isn't somebody you should have because it doesn't look good. So, it doesn't look good to appoint somebody that the city has been spending literal millions of dollars with over the last couple of years.
Well, the thing is, it takes two to tango. It's not like Don Brown unilaterally stepped into this position, right? Like, obviously,
I'm talking from the perspective, yeah, of the governor. Yes. This isn't somebody you should appoint.
Yes. And the thing is, like you said, I'm grateful for people who do business here, a business owner. And it's one of those things where even if everything is on the up and up, which I'm going to assume it is, I'm assuming everything's on the up and up, and that, you know, Don Brown obviously wants what's best for St. Louis. The governor wants what's best for St. Louis. The governor grew up in the city of St. Louis, grew up in North City. And we all know, whether it is the city of St. Louis to St. Louis County to now to St. Charles County, we need the city to thrive. We need it to thrive because you can't be a suburb of nowhere. You can't survive as a donut. We get that. But in this type of situation, I think it is of utmost importance to avoid any semblance at all of impropriety in, yeah, any way, especially when you have a city that's probably not super thrilled about the state being able to appoint this board of commissioners to run the police department. I would feel like in this type of situation, you'd want to go out of your way,
correct,
to just avoid any
impropriety
or conflict of interest.
That is exactly the point, because voters in the city voted years ago to have the police control under the city's umbrella. They did not vote for this. They did not vote for the state of Missouri taking the police department and control of it. That's not what they want. And and it doesn't poll very well in the city. So, you know, maybe it is a thing where it's going to work out great, and hopefully it does. It may have worked out fine anyway because the numbers were trending in the right direction. I think we have a pretty good police chief in Robert Tracy. So I think we were heading in the right direction anyway. The trend was correct. I don't know that this was necessary. But if you're going to do it and force it on the city, which is what was done by the state, then you better, everything better be proper. Everything. And even if there isn't impropriety here, even if it's just that Governor Kehoe really thinks that Don Brown's going to do right by the city and his intentions are pure when it comes to the police department, maybe all of that is true. It can't look like it may not be.
So, and this story, written at length by KMOX reporter Sean Malone, he spoke with Alderman Rasheen Aldridge, and Alderman Aldridge did have some concerns, hesitations about Don Brown being the commissioner of the board. It's important to note that Don Brown is the only non-voting member of the board. So there is that. But Rasheen Aldridge just said, you know, ultimately, because there's millions of dollars being exchanged between the police department and like the Don Brown car dealership, he thought it might create an improper relationship. And he did say, quote, "I want to first say I think Don Brown has been a great partner for the city of St. Louis. But when it comes to Brown being on the board that governs the police department," he said, quote, "yeah, I do think there is a little bit of a conflict of interest." Sean Malone did note in his story, Sean Malone said that
on KMOX.com.
KMOX.com, that Alderman Aldridge praised the dealership numerous times during our conversation. So there's no accusations here.
Right,
there's
right,
nothing.
Right.
And like I said, for Sean Malone to go out of his way to say, "I want to make sure I'm not misrepresenting this," that Alderman Aldridge has been praising Don Brown and the dealership and the partnership. But just, I do think it's a fair question to say, maybe that's, again, you just want to avoid any semblance, any appearance, anything that can be misconstrued as a conflict
especially
of interest.
Especially because leadership in the city is not entirely sure whether or not they want to pursue a lawsuit. I know Megan Green has already filed one, taken it down and refiled it. The Kara Spencer, the mayor, has not committed to that, but also did not want police takeover. So just because it is one of those things where not a lot of people here in the city of St. Louis wanted that, you've got to, this has to look right. You know, everything has to look right just because it is controversial.
So and again, like Don Brown has provided or had has had deals with multiple police departments across the region. And this particular deal with the city of St. Louis has been in place for decades, multiple decades. But maybe this is a case where either if he is on the board, do you recuse yourself from that car deal, that dealership, you're not selling to the police department while you're on the board? I mean, I know that's a big loss.
I don't know how you do that.
I know. Or do you just say, hey, maybe I shouldn't be on the board? But if you're going to be on the board, maybe you just say, I'll sell to other police departments, but while I'm on the board, I can't sell to the city. The thing is, if the city, that could put the city in a bind because we know city governments, they have to get estimates. They have to make a deal with a dealership to try to make the best use of taxpayer dollars. So I don't think it would be an easy switch to say, oh, we're just not going to use you anymore. We're going to go somewhere else.
Earlier today, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth had a press conference on U.S. intelligence reports on the U.S. bombing in Iran that took place last weekend. We will talk to White House correspondent for The Bulwark, Andrew Egger. He is next. St. Louisan joins the show when we come back on KMOX.
Let me read the bottom line here. President Trump directed the most complex and secretive military operation in history, and it was a resounding success, resulting in a ceasefire agreement and the end of the 12-day war.
Was it D-Day? Okay. Usually at this time, we talk to our guy, Major Garrett,
That's right.
Every 10:30 on Thursdays, but for some reason, he's off work.
I think he big-timed us.
Unacceptable.
Unacceptable,
but,
Major.
But this is great. We get to talk to St. Louisan and White House correspondent for The Bulwark, Andrew Egger, who is with us on KMOX. You just heard from Defense Secretary Hegseth. Andrew, it's good to talk to you. How are you?
Hey, guys, doing well. Big shoes to fill with Major, but I'll do my best.
Well, and I don't think you know this yet, but I think we've officially put your name in for when Major can't make it, which occasionally happens. Mm-hmm. I think it's Andrew. So, surprise!
Also, also the understudy. Yeah, sounds good.
We should let you know there's no money in it for you.
I hear that a lot. Most of these things, you know, yeah.
That's our slogan. Yeah. The Christy and Amy Show.
There's no money in it.
That's right.
All right. So what did you make of that comment? It hit me in particular because I thought, what, have we not had other really great secret military operations like, was it Normandy one? What did you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you almost, your eyes start to glaze over anytime any sort of Trump underling or cabinet secretary or booster or spokesman or anything, anytime they start talking about the most X in history or the greatest Y in history, I mean, it's almost like a card they have to punch, right? Because that's what Trump likes to hear, and that's what they say. At the same time, I mean, I don't think we should undersell at all the kind of complexity of the mission and the success of the mission to at least a great extent, right? I mean, the secretary is completely within his rights to talk about the fact that this thing was planned secretly, went off without a hitch. The misdirections that they put in place seem to have worked, and I mean, they hit their targets. They all came home, and Iran doesn't seem to have been expecting it. So I think that you know, while we can kind of roll our eyes and laugh at sort of some of the Trumpian language that's in play here, that obviously Pete Hegseth speaks very fluently, he's absolutely right about the underlying facts of the sort of professionalism and discipline, yeah, and strong planning of the military strike.
Yeah, Andrew, to that point, you know, Hegseth, he is the Secretary of Defense. I will say sometimes when he speaks, it feels more like he is a Fox News host, right? Which, of course, is what he was. So it would be natural for him to fall into that mode. Not my favorite for the Secretary of Defense. And that's a shame because, as you mentioned, it was an incredibly complex and successful mission. We spoke with former Commanding General Mark Hertling earlier on in the week, and I asked him my dumb civilian question, which was, so was it kind of like Top Gun Maverick? And he said it was, but harder. And in that sense, there's a huge sense of patriotism and pride in our military and what they were able to accomplish.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a real split screen here for Hegseth in particular, because like you say, you know, he came in without any kind of managerial experience at this level. He'd run small, you know, nonprofits, and he had made his bones on Fox News. There were a lot of questions about his ability to manage an organization like this. And again, to be fair, like there's been a lot of hiccups and stumbles, and I mean the political leadership of DOD over there, there's been all kinds of news about kind of his paranoia about leaks and his firing aides left and right. So there's been a lot of turmoil on the political side. But I think that you have to acknowledge that this, you know, this is at least a very strong data point in the opposite direction, that when it really counts, you know, when it's rubber hitting road in terms of a military operation, they're not accidentally putting, you know, Jeffrey Goldberg on the text chain talking about it. And they're not, you know, having screaming matches behind the scenes, you know, that hurt the effectiveness of the mission. And that's a point in his favor for sure.
Yeah, so I don't know. It seems that there's a discrepancy here in just how successful the mission was with the intelligence reports. They don't seem to, at this point anyway, back up what the president said about the capabilities being obliterated. So when do you think we're going to have a better idea of what actually happened and just how successful it was?
Well, and this is the tough thing about all of this, right, is there's never easy answers to this kind of question, because of the fact that what we're doing is we're flying a bunch of planes over there, we're dropping the bombs, we're flying home, and then we have to go right back to relying on, you know, satellite surveillance and you know, human sources on the ground in terms of gathering up intelligence and things like this. So these sorts of questions are always tricky. It's part of the reason why, you know, previous actions of this. It's part of the reason why you put boots on the ground in Iraq 20 years ago, because, you know, strikes alone, it's hard to know whether you got everything you were looking to get. And there's a million other, you know, difficult questions like that. The other problem is that there has now been this kind of dry question, this kind of nuts and bolts question of how do we get the intelligence? How do we assess the intelligence? How do we make the best judgment call? How does the intelligence community make the best judgment calls of how to parse that raw intelligence? And that has all now been kind of swallowed into this broader political conflict because, there was that one very preliminary, very kind of low certainty report that got leaked, which, newsrooms obviously wrote up because it was an internal Trump administration intelligence report, which was going contrary to the sort of public triumphalism that we were hearing from the White House that they were saying they knew that the facilities had been obliterated and Iran's nuclear program had been bombed back to the Stone Age and all of this stuff. And well, maybe not. It's hard to say. But now, and Pete Eggs, I've talked about this a little bit this morning. He got some questions of, well, okay, a couple days ago, you guys were all saying it was far too early to give kind of an intelligence assessment. Now you're all rushing out in the wake of this reporting to say, well, here's a bunch of other intelligence assessments we have that say it was actually great and say it actually did accomplish its mission. And it's just hard to parse all that because obviously there's a lot of pressure for the administration to get behind the president's narrative on this stuff. That's not to say the first report was absolutely correct either. So there's a lot of fog of war, a lot of new kind of like political angles mm-hmm. pushed into all of this. And the bottom line is it's too early to say now, and hopefully it won't be too early to say later.
Yeah, I think it's the fog of war. Also, it's so politicized. It really is. You talked about the intel of whether it was obliterated or not obliterated. I've seen some of the same sources, more of like the talking heads or media or whatever, at one point saying, well, Iran doesn't even have nuclear capabilities. They don't have these facilities. They're not even close. And then once Trump said they were obliterated, they said, no, they're totally intact. They're still fine. And I feel like it's hard to find the truth in this charged of an atmosphere.
Yeah. And again, it's also just a really complicated question, right? I mean, like the question is like the underlying question, overarching question is simple. Like, does Iran have the capability of putting together a nuclear weapon sometime soon? But the number of kind of like smaller intermediary steps there mm-hmm. are legion, right? I mean, like what the U.S. was hoping to do with this strike in a perfect world would have been to damage these enrichment facilities kind of beyond the point of no return, where Iran would have to build new ones if it wanted to keep enriching uranium and keep, building, warhead capabilities and the missiles and all these facilities. And we wanted to hopefully get the enriched uranium that they already have. And it seems like, again, there's so much fog of war, but it seems like we did the first half of that, right? That at least some of the facilities were devastated in Fordo and in other places. But it also seems, again, in a very preliminary way, that maybe Iran was able to move the enriched uranium it already has off-site. It's not that hard to do. You just put it in a truck. It's not like thousands and thousands of tons of uranium that they have on hand. It's, relatively small payload in sort of concrete terms. So that could be anywhere, right? And that's, again, the kind of hard thing to assess, just from like satellite imaging and all this sort of thing. So when you put those kind of complicated questions up against this sort of narrative that's coming out of the White House, no, we got it all, we're done, we did great, it's over, and anybody who says otherwise hates America and hates the troops, it gets kind of hard to sort of parse these things out. And not that it wouldn't be otherwise. Again, there's a lot of fog of war here.
Andrew Egger from The Bulwark, White House correspondent. We appreciate you jumping in with us today. And just know that you are now on call. So that's what all this money is getting us. We're getting you on call for the price of nothing. So thank you.
This is what you do. This is what you do. You trade in perks, right? You trade on my hometown pride. You get me in there. It works great. Hit me up anytime.
We'll get you some Cardinals tickets.
We'll hook you up with some sweet Cardinals tickets the next time you're in town.
No, not Cardinals tickets in a suite. I mean, come on. We're not going to go that far.
We can't get them to the Champions Club? I think we can get you Champions Club.
We'll see what we could do, Andrew.
We'll see what we can do.
All right. Thanks, guys. I appreciate
but you have
it.
To come visit. You got to come visit.
Thank you, Andrew.
We appreciate it. Andrew Egger, White House correspondent for The Bulwark, joining us here. Yes, St. Louisan. Cardinals fan. He grew up here in
the area. As he likes to call it, he's a 314.
You know, we asked the question of the week, and we need to give you an update as to where we are. And I am violating a very, very big rule that have here in America,
which is interesting,
allegedly,
because we felt violated earlier today with our creepy producer taking pictures of your gams.
What? Chris and Amy on KMOX. It's Amy Marks, Kors, and Chris Ranji. We are we're having a great hot day. Speaking of hot, you should have seen me when I walked in this building. The looks I was getting, and it wasn't like
a schwitzing.
It wasn't like a, oh my God, what is that? It was, what is that? That's the look. Ooh. That's the kind of look I was getting from people.
I don't think so. Because I think you were blinding with your white caps.
No. I came in here. I am wearing shorts to work.
Yeah. No, he came into this building assaulting people.
No.
Actively assaulting people.
There were so many, as I walked in from the front, I can't count the amount of people
because there
who
were zero.
Stopped
yeah.
and gave that look like, well, hello, who are you? To me. They were doing that to me because I walked in shorts in the office. I came into the office in shorts today, which is a huge office no-no, or so I am told.
Was it?
I hate that rule.
Was it Julie Tristan over at Y98?
No, not even her. She's nice to everybody, so she would never say anything that is, I think, critical of you.
You could tell if she was just awestruck.
No, it wasn't her. It was just, I mean, there's so many ladies that were just at the front, from the front door all the way to our office.
And you know what's amazing is I 100% believe him, which is crazy because I didn't see anybody say anything or look at you or notice that you're even here.
You were in the office already. Yeah, you didn't see all the people who were just surrounding me Harry Styles. They were around
were
me
Harry
like
Legs.
I was Harry Styles.
You were Harry Legs.
Yes.
Robert wants to know, Ranj, because now you're confusing people. Was that the debut of Nice Package?
This is not these are not short shorts. These are not jean cutoffs. These are just regular, actually, I think these are golf shorts. I don't know what they are. But I do know this. We're going to the ball game today.
We are going to the ball game.
I do think that it is okay. If you have this office rule where shorts are not allowed, if you're leaving the office to go to a day baseball game when it is 1,000 degrees, this is okay. Now, it's in conflict with the idea that you're not supposed to wear shorts to the office and really in conflict with the high-end fashion people who say that men should never wear shorts ever unless it's an athletic activity. We have a Twitter poll at Chris Amy KMOX. We want you to follow us and go there and vote. Find our Twitter poll. Should men be able to wear shorts? And it's a very simple yes or no.
Well, I know it's too simple. I'm accepting this under protest because we should have had three options. Yes, no, and yes, but not in professional environments, because obviously you'll wear shorts to the beach. You would look silly if you wore pants to the beach. You would look silly if you wore pants to the pool, but you look silly in shorts in this building. And thank goodness that you wore tennis shoes and not flip-flops, because I think legally we could execute you for wearing shorts and flip-flops to work.
Calm down. It is not that bad.
It's pretty bad.
No, it isn't. I think I look great.
I feel harassed.
Here's a text that says, if men wear closed-toe shoes with shorts, that is more professional. Sandals or flip-flops on men are not professional for the office. So, thank you. That's from a 618. Mm-hmm. That person gets it. Mm-hmm. That's the way it should be.
Are we going to go ahead and give the results of the poll or not until tomorrow? Can we just say where it's at so that way certain people can really step up?
I am going to be out tomorrow, but I will be listening in to see what happens. I think I know what's going to happen here. Most people are in agreement with me. I think there are people who, you say it's unprofessional to wear shorts. Let's say you're coming into the office as an outsider, and you're coming in to do business. If you see somebody in shorts, are you just going to turn around and walk out?
Probably. Mike.
But what if they're really good at their jobs?
Mike on Twitter, he said that it is okay. Yes, men can wear shorts unless they're the boss of a crime family. Apparently in The Sopranos, a Don doesn't wear shorts.
Oh.
I can see that.
Okay.
I can see how it's a less authoritative, a little bit less intimidating. Ben, also on Twitter, said, I'm so glad that I'm a PE teacher. I wear golf shorts every day, even in winter. Comfort is key.
Listener Larry has texted in and says, don't worry, Chris. You're allowed to wear shorts because Amy makes your job non-professional. Hey, thank you.
Okay, Larry.
I don't even know what that means.
Go get wrecked, Larry. Amy, a different Amy, watching us on YouTube, she said, when I had my job interview for my current job, my now boss, she's really outing this guy.
Wow.
My now boss was wearing shorts and a Cardinals jersey when he interviewed me. No joke.
Oh.
Do you work for the Cardinals?
Hey, let's get to a call. In Ferguson, Super Cool the DJ is with us on KMOX. What's going on?
I see a lot of people wearing shorts everywhere I go, in town and out of town. Me and them women can wear them. Ain't no problem with them.
Yeah, that's okay, right?
The men look good in shorts anyway. When you look good in shorts, that's when all the ladies chase us men.
Yeah, that's right.
I love it when the men look good in shorts.
That's what happened to me when the ladies chase them. When I walked in the office today, that's what happened.
Wow.
All the ladies here.
Wow.
Of all ages. It was unbelievable.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I wish I would have seen this, missed it, missed all of it, missed all the commotion, even missed the people. They must have all gone home early.
No.
Did they go home as you showed up?
No, it was unbelievable. I had not experienced anything like that in a week.
So they didn't feel, when they saw you, they didn't feel assaulted.
No, assaulted. They were delighted.
I do know this. You have jury duty, Ronj. Do not wear shorts to jury duty. I had a friend in the city of St. Louis, got called for jury duty, as you often do, and he texted me at like 10 a.m. He goes, they sent me home. I said, why? He goes, apparently you have to wear pants to jury duty.
Wait.
And I said, you didn't wear pants? Well, he wore shorts. But not only did they send him home, but they made him go home and change and come back.
Oh, I thought you were going to say they sent him home and said, you're finished.
The judge sent him home and said, go put on pants and come back.
Oh, come on, man. I thought I had an out.
I know.
This texter says, because Ronji used to work for the Sox, this is a good question. Does he think any MLB team should wear shorts for a uniform like the Sox did for a 1976 doubleheader? Have you seen those uniforms?
No, I have not.
Okay, go look up the White Sox.
How do you slide in shorts?
I don't know, but they looked like, remember in the 80s, the softball shorts that men used to wear when they were playing softball?
I'm looking at them right now.
Like the coach's shorts? The White Sox wore those for at least one game. I think it was maybe just those two. Awful.
Okay, I don't know, though. I am looking at one picture. This guy looks pretty good. I don't know who this is.
Well, I can't see it from where you are. Is that Chet Lemon? I can't tell.
I can't tell.
All right. Anyway. But yeah, I think you should be able to wear shorts. I think it's awesome. So are you familiar with the South Broadway Athletic Club, Amy?
Yes.
Boxing. It's been around for well over 100 years, and there are so many cool events that go on there, like boxing and wrestling and all kinds of great stuff. There's a new book out about it. Miriam Moynihan and Dan Gunther, both worked on that book, and they are here in studio. Tell us about all the cool history of the South Broadway Athletic Club next on KMOX.